Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. Jump in Tucson's Monday theme is Wonder, where we celebrate the good things going on at the University of Arizona, including student projects, student learning, student outcomes, which are really important, as well as top-level performances by artists and athletes, and especially top-tier research going on with faculty and scientists at the University of Arizona. We have one of those people with us this morning who is doing top-tier research that's affecting the world and affecting our understanding of who we are as people and where we come from and what we've done over the years. Welcome, Dr. Terry Hunt. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So you're a professor of anthropology at the School of Anthropology. I know you from your time as the dean of the Honors College, and you've been at the U of A for a while. Could you just give us a little bit of your educational journey?
Sure. My educational career began with University of Hawaii, where I got involved in archaeology early in my career. I went on to graduate school at University of Auckland in New Zealand, where I was fortunate enough to work in the Pacific Islands, places like Samoa and Fiji and New Zealand. I went to University of Washington for my PhD, and during my time doing my PhD, I worked in Fiji, Samoa, and then my dissertation in Papua New Guinea, some small islands there. So I've been all over the Pacific. I taught at University of Hawaii for about 25 years and came to the mainland about 10 years ago and joined University of Arizona about 7 years ago.
That's great. So what is your current assignment at the University of Arizona in the college or the School of Anthropology?
I'm a professor in the School of Anthropology and doing research and teaching classes and working with my colleagues in the School of Anthropology. Proud to be there. It's a great great bunch of faculty.
Yeah. Do you have large classes? Are you in the undergraduate early stages of their anthropological career, or are you doing doctoral students in smaller size groups?
We do both. Faculty will teach a lower division introductory course and an upper division course. So I'm teaching courses like world archaeology, which is a lot of fun because we get to sort of see what's happening all over the world, which is, you know, it's great to keep up with that. And then last semester, for example, I taught a course on using drones in mapping, which is something that I'm doing in my research. And so students were learning how to fly drones and use the software to make really state-of-the-art maps, which is just technology has really changed archaeology a lot in just the last few years.
You also spent some time over at the Honors College as the dean there, and what a beautiful facility that, that the honor students now have. It's gorgeous, and there's a lot of wonderful things coming out of the Honors College with student projects and so forth, and they kind of do the regular curriculum that an average student does, but then they add some things to many of their courses and do a dissertation kind of a thing at the end. So how was that for you when you were in administration and handling the Honors College as well as the other duties that you had?
Well, for me, Honors is really special because I am really committed to undergraduate success. I believe that undergraduate research and mentoring undergraduates is really part of quality education. So at a big university, the Honors College is an opportunity for students to get involved on a more personal level with their professors and with research. I was dean for 5 years. We named the college. We built a new building, and we saw a lot of success, and I'm very proud of that. We built some new programs, and 5 years, then I said, okay, back to research and teaching, and I'm enjoying that as well.
I have to say, when the Honors College was being built, I got the tour, the hard hat tour, they called it, where you got to go around and see the housing and the big giant rooms and the cafeterias and all the things that were going to be there. And it was impressive then to see them, what they were building. And now when you see it, what an impressive unit that is. And, you know, for all the years preceding that, the honors students really didn't have a place to land. And so it's nice to be able to focus on academics and focus on student learning in a really powerful way. So kudos to you and the team that put together a really enjoyable, and the Eller College, we teach a lot of honors students because it's just really taken off and it's really powerful.
True, yes, and we're really proud of our students and our partnerships across campus, and well, Eller is one of our key allies on campus.
Yeah. obviously, you've been in the South Pacific. You from Hawaii to Papua New Guinea, and all the places that you have been. One of the fun ones is Easter Island. And we're going to talk after the break about the research that's going on there now and what you're doing. But can you just kind of tell us a little bit about one of the most remote places in the world and what Easter Island and why it's called Easter Island and where it is in relation to the United States?
Well, Easter Island, or also known as Rapa Nui, is the modern traditional name. It's in the remote southeastern Pacific. It really is probably truly the most isolated inhabited place on Earth. It's about 2,500 miles from the mainland of Chile. It's about another 2,500 miles heading the other direction to Tahiti. Really in the middle of nowhere, and the island is tiny. It's about 12 miles by 7 miles, and there's about 5,000 people living there. It's a territory of Chile, and of course, it has the most amazing archaeology in the world, I think.
Right. And so you were down there. We actually were trying to connect a couple of weeks ago to see if we could do this interview there, but it is obviously very tourist oriented now because of where it is, and we'll be talking about the Moai a little bit. But so there's 5,000 people that live there, but there's another tens of thousands of people that make their way through Easter Island through cruise ships and flying in on a regular basis, right?
Yeah, tourism post-COVID has really rebounded. It's somewhere between 150, maybe close to 200,000 visitors a year. That's a dramatic increase from 20 years ago when there would be 2,000 or 3,000 visitors a year. There are daily flights from Santiago, Chile. Cruise ships do call into Rapa Nui. And tourism is big, and it really supports the economy of the island.
And it's a small island. It's a mountaintop in one of those Pacific mountain ranges, and it's the very tippy top of a giant mountain out in the middle of nowhere. And it's gotten a little smaller lately with the rise in the oceans. It's lost a little bit of landmass recently. And so there is some concern about its longevity, but we can talk about that a little bit in terms of its future as opposed to its history. But why is it called Easter Island?
Yeah, Easter Island. On Easter Sunday in 1722, Captain Jacob Roggeveen, a Dutch explorer, sighted the island, and so they named it Easter Island. They went ashore. They were the first European visitors, and they found about 3,000 islanders there. They also shot some of them, and there were some interactions that were, you know, unfortunate, and then some that were kind of what happens when explorers arrive on islands. The modern traditional name, Rapa Nui, comes from the 19th century, and there are other names that apply to the island.
Great. An Easter Island on Easter Sunday. So, okay. When we come back after the break, we'll talk about your research on Easter Island. We're talking with Dr. Terry Hunt. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday Wonder Edition, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona in research and other wonderful places. One of those researchers that's doing great work is Dr. Terry Hunt, and doing some research on the wonderful Pacific island of which we call Easter Island. And so let's talk a little bit about those structures that you were talking about that are probably one of the most famous in the world, the Moai.
Well, of course, Easter Island is famous for its Moai, and there are about 1,000 on the island. they're giant human statues. They're not heads, but torsos. They have hands down to the waist. Most of them, over 95%, were carved from one volcanic crater that formed a kind of solidified volcanic ash that's very good for carving. And then they were transported to every part of the island. The Moai have become iconic. They're really the reason why we all know about Easter Island. These famous giant figures on an island with a small population, an isolated island with limited resources, an island that was isolated for its entire history until European contact, and really formed kind of a story about the mystery of Easter Island, like who made these statues and why and what happened. And there have been many stories told that, you know, we can talk about. Some of them have become myths as we learn more, and we're learning probably the real history of the island now.
part of the tourism attraction, obviously, is the people on the cruise ships and people flying over from Santiago every day. They're coming to see the Moai because they are fascinating. It's kind of the Stonehenge of the Pacific, if you will, with these huge 1,000 human-like figures that are up all around the island. But there is a myth that's out there that that the folks that were living there, that maybe they exhausted the land and all of the things that they were living on and killed off the seabirds and exhausted the soils and ruined their environment, and that's why it was barren and so forth. And so in 1722, when they came, you know, this myth is that, you know, this is the myth, right? That they kind of used up their environment till the end.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great description. The idea is that the island was overpopulated, that the islanders used up their resources, and some have even called it Moai mania, right, for the statues. And the idea that there was some crazy obsession with making these giant statues, some of them up to 80 tons that were moved several miles across the island, and that somehow this was a drain on resources. You know, when we take a look at this in terms of the history, and we go farther back in time historically using archaeology, this myth starts to fall apart. Let's take Easter 1722, for example, when the Dutch arrive. They actually describe the island, in their words, as an earthly paradise. And they make a very interesting comment that the island could support more people if they decided to grow more food, which to us suggests that the island was sustainable because one doesn't want to maximize production, one wants to stabilize production. So you don't always go for the max because that will fail and you'll have too many people relying on that maximum. So the first visitors really found that earthly paradise. The myth about destruction really comes in 1774, the third European visit with Captain James Cook. They saw destroyed monuments. The Moai, many of the Moai had been had fallen or been knocked down. They actually saw human bones on the surface. The story begins in 1774, and modern scholars have taken Cook's observations and sort of treated it as historical fact. And they were factual observations, but they were seeing something that was the aftermath of European visitors, not the pre-European history of the island.
Right. And so we're talking with Dr. Terry Hunt, who's a professor of anthropology in the School of Anthropology at the University of Arizona and an expert on Easter Island. And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, sweet potatoes was one of the major crops that the native people that live there, for who are descendants of those from long ago, are still using the sweet potato as a main, along with marine life and other things, to sustain themselves. So can you talk a little bit about the rock gardening and why that's so important on this island?
Sure. And yes, I'm just back from Rapa Nui, and yes, we do eat a lot of sweet potatoes and fish. So
yeah.
The soils on the island are really nutrient poor. They're excessively drained, and they lose nutrients quickly. The rock gardening on the island is really important, and it's an ingenious solution because what the islanders did was they realized that the rocks could solve several problems. One, they could retain moisture in the soil. Two, they could really moderate the temperature from night to day in an environment that's a little more seasonal than other Pacific islands. And probably most importantly, the rocks, as younger geologic material, added nutrients to the soil and directly available to the plants. So large portions of the island are covered in rock mulch. It's just kind of small boulders that have been collected, and the plants are grown in that rocky area. Of course, early European visitors, saw rock mulch, and they misunderstood. They sort of saw the opposite, that, oh, these pitiful people have to grow their crops in rocks. If only they could plow. Well, if you plowed the soil on Rapa Nui and planted crops, there would be no nutrients. So they had an ingenious solution that really led to sustainable agriculture on the island.
So you earlier mentioned drones and mapping of the agricultural areas. So you have your current research is to try to bust that myth that they used up their environment and that was, you know, kind of not really what happened, and that agriculture continues, it still continues today, and that through mapping the island, you can kind of make a different narrative out of it, right?
Absolutely. And our approach over the last 24 years has been really evidence-based. We went to the island thinking we understood a lot of the story, but the evidence wasn't adding up. And so we've spent a lot of time doing really primary documentation. And today that involves mapping with drones, 3D modeling and really high precision, really efficient mapping. We used to do that with pencil and graph paper, and now we do it with drones. So in that work, we're actually seeing the extent of the rock mulch, the monuments that are built, their association with resources. We're mapping the Moai, we're mapping the Moai carving area in the quarry. So all of this work is underway now and continuing. There's still a lot to do.
Yeah. If someone wanted to find out more about the about Easter Island, but find out more about your research and what you are doing in the School of Anthropology and what your expertise is, can they go somewhere and find out some of the stuff that you're doing? Can they go to the U of A websites and see where you are and what you're doing?
Yes, School of Anthropology. My website has several of my publications that I've done with my colleagues, and so there's some sort of a current selection there of things that we're researching and writing about. You could also go to our book, The Statues That Walked. That's kind of a narrative of our discovery of a story that we believed was one thing and turned out to be another, which is a good thing in scientific research. You know, find out that you were wrong.
And you were also involved in the documentary to show how they moved those Moai from one side of the island to the other and kind of came up with a theory of how these things were moved many years ago.
Yes, many years ago, we were involved in a National Geographic NOVA documentary. And part of that work was really testing a theory that grew out of observations we made on the island. And we made a perfect replica of a statue that was being transported on the island and fell during transport, but through kind of 3D printing technology, Structure for Motion software is what it's called, we made a perfect replica, and then we were able to experiment with a replica like none other. No one had ever made a replica that was a perfect copy. They'd sort of made, I call them facsimiles, because they'd sort of made something that they thought looked like a Moai, but we didn't have to make something we thought looked like a Moai. We just copied one of theirs and tried to, you know, turn the keys and see if it would go.
Right, and so you used logs and ropes and people and figured out how to move it and kind of came up again with a theory of how these were moved from one side of the island to the other, which is part of the mystery of Easter Island, is how do these gigantic, 1,000 enormous rock structures all around the island, how did they move them around? Well, Dr. Terry Hunt, Professor of Anthropology, School of Anthropology, University of Arizona, and an expert on Easter Island. It's a very interesting career path that you've had, a very interesting, you spent a lot of time in the Pacific Ocean, and hopefully Easter Island will be around for a while. There is some concern that maybe the rising water of the oceans and the melting of the icebergs and so forth, that there might be some damage to the coastline. It may not be 12 miles wide anymore. It may get down to less than that. So what's the future of Easter Island, do you think?
Well, there are a lot of concerns about the future, and climate change is on people's minds. What's happening right now is that there are more severe events. There's more severe rainstorms. There are more severe droughts. And we've recently seen really severe storm surge with rise in sea level and increased storminess. the storm surges now will come on shore, and they're damaging the monuments, most of which are built on the shoreline. So
we got to save those.
Yeah, lots of concern with that.
We've got to save those. Well, thank you for visiting today. We've been talking with Dr. Terry Hunt from the University of Arizona, an expert on Easter Island and the famous Moai, which adorned the island, and the wonderful people that created them, and his new theory of how the sustainability of the people that live there and their environment is really good. Thank you for joining us today, Terry. And you're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI, the Wonder Series, talking about the good things at the University of Arizona. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson, appropriate music for the University of Arizona Wonder Series, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona and the Wonder Campaign and the success of students and faculty and staff and the community and all the good things going on. One of the most visible parts of the U of A is the Pride of Arizona, the University of Arizona Marching Band, a tradition in Tucson and Southern Arizona for many, many years. We're fortunate to have a good friend and the director of the Marching Band, the Pride of Arizona, Chad Shootman. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So first off, congratulations on getting your tenure and becoming a tenured professor at the University of Arizona. Long haul, but excellent and good job.
No, thank you very much. It's one of the big honors of my life and my career. So it's exciting. Got that a couple of years ago and am thrilled to be on the team officially.
Yeah. So you're from the U of A, from Tucson, and then went off for a while. So tell us a little bit about your journey and what brought you back to Tucson as a director.
Well, I went to high school at Canyon Del Oro High School and was recruited to come to U of A as a trumpet player and ended up getting my bachelor's in music education and my master's in conducting performance at U of A. And during that time, I was a member of the Pride of Arizona. I was drum major of the Pride of Arizona and then a grad student for the Pride of Arizona. And so I got to see, gosh, all the big wins and big moments in Arizona athletics history. Back in that time, I was drum major during the Fiesta Bowl and the Holiday Bowl and got to take the band on our national championship run in 1997 with the basketball team, which was fantastic. And so I just I'm a lifelong U of A fan. I call myself a homer because I'm repping the red, white, and blue all the time. So that part of it's great. And then I had an opportunity to go work for the Walt Disney World Company in Orlando, Florida as a performer, a conductor, an arranger, gosh, even a choreographer, and did a lot of recording, studio recording, live performance, worked in their education side of that company where we would do clinics for bands and visiting students and groups like that, which was a lot of fun. And then the opportunity to come home to a place that meant so much to me and had such an impact on my life and be able to share my life experience with a whole new generation of students was something I couldn't pass up. Got me to bring my daughter back to see her grandparents because my folks still live here. My sister lives here. And it was a chance to just come home in a lot of ways. And I couldn't pass up the opportunity. And it's been great leading a program that was so important to me at a university that helped shape who I am.
So you're an associate professor, you're the associate director of bands and the director of the athletic bands at the U of A, so you are a pretty busy guy, right?
It is definitely a busy schedule. It is something that, you know, I teach, I work for the School of Music and the College of Fine Arts, which is great, love that, conducting ensembles, teaching music courses, and then working for athletics with the athletic band, so the pep band, the marching band, but that includes the palm line, the color guard, the twirlers, our drum line. It is a huge, you know, 300-person kind of enterprise, if you will, that supports Arizona athletics, but also the university when we, you know, open a new building and things like that. I want the Pride to be there. So those two jobs are in one with me, and it's a great honor to get to do it. But yeah, it definitely is a busy, busy job.
When you have your kickoff band kickoff, you often make note of the fact that the number of members in the band, and then you do something unique. You have all the people stand up that are not music majors standing up and being recognized, and it's most of the students stand up are not music majors, correct?
That's true. It's one of the cool things, I think, because it's a true representation of the university. there are over 100 different majors in the Pride of Arizona. So the university provides probably 150 majors, 150 plus, and 100 of those are represented in the Pride of Arizona. I don't think there's another more representative group on campus for the university than the Pride. And so it's it is something I'm very proud of, to use that word a lot, pride and proud, that we're able to impact so many students across campus and give them an opportunity to not only support their university, but also learn about leadership and working with people that don't see the world the same, because there's so many different students coming at this organization. And so we come together in a shared vision of performance excellence. And so it's an opportunity for them to stay connected to the arts and making music and performing for 50,000 people every week and being on national TV and also having a front row seat to some of the great events at the university and the great happenings at the university. And then being able to make lifelong friends in a variety of fields that I think it makes it a uniquely special organization that I think the university and the Tucson community is very proud of, and rightly so. I always brag I have the best students. But yeah, less than 10% are music majors.
We're talking to Chad Schupman, who is the director of athletic bands, the Pride of Arizona, the U of A marching band. You know, when an average fan goes to the Arizona Stadium and before the game, or definitely at halftime when the band does their performance, I'm not sure a lot of people think about what goes into that and how that all happens. So talk a little bit about Bandcamp, which is coming up here pretty quick, and how you get the students ready for that awesome, that seven home games and that experience. Plus then the pep band goes on throughout the basketball time. So it's daunting, isn't it?
It really is. I think people don't associate it necessarily with the same sort of energy and meticulous awareness that like sports have, but there's a very direct parallel. It's a physical activity where we're asking students to move their feet at 190 beats a minute at times and manage their breath and dance and twirl and spin and throw things in the air and catch them, all while moving to synchronized movement. But you know, band camp is similar to spring training or two-a-days if you're into the football parlance. It really is. These are long days. It accounts for 30% of our total rehearsal time for the year, because we want to be ready and need to be ready for that first game. It is not something that we build to over the course of the season. We have to impact that first game with high quality, high energy, excellent product that reaches a diverse audience that we want to be able to make sure everybody's proud of. So yeah, these students work tirelessly. I think people don't realize after every home game, we go and watch film of our performance that night on campus. And I give away a game ball and awards for the week leading up to it. And then we watch film that night. So sometimes those students aren't getting home till 1 or 2 in the morning after a game. There's a lot of parallels there, and the amount of time they put in behind the scenes is far greater than the performance time they give, but they work really, really hard to put on a show that I think they're very proud of, and we're certainly proud of. We hope Tucson is as well.
You have an alumni presence from time to time. They come in and perform and so forth. These are lifelong friendships that are being formed in these experiences. If they're in for 4 years, then they really develop a camaraderie between the band. You can just see it when you go out there and talk to them, especially if you're in a section like the drum line or one of the sections. They tend to kind of gravitate with each other and become friends, and it's amazing the social dynamic that accompanies the whole musical experience.
That's really true, and it's interesting because it's people that may not have ever met each other at U of A otherwise.
Right.
We have so many couples that go on and get married that come out of the band. We have donors now that met in the band and got married, and so it's a really neat thing, and it connects people across generations of U of A students, because you can, you know, you say Bear Down, Go Cats, you've got that song that you share together, but the amount of hours you put in trying to work towards something that is highly intricate and excellent, and the way you blood, sweat, and tears together builds a bond. When you're using a shared vision for anything that you want to do, the idea that you're working on something together and you're there for that person and that person's there for you, that sort of bonding doesn't necessarily happen in a regular course.
Right.
Whereas this one, it does, and we empower our students to lead and make decisions and take ownership and hopefully be proud of the fact that they had a part in that.
Yet when we you mentioned the fact that the social dynamic and so forth, I'm not sure there's short of the national anthem, I'm not sure there's another song that could be played to bring about the community engagement and people perking up and being excited when the band takes off and plays Bear Down. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit about tradition and excellent and a great award that you've received. And we'll talk about how people can help the U of A marching band, the Pride of Arizona. We're talking with Chad Shoopman, who is the director. And one of the great things that goes on at the University of Arizona in the Wonder program, the Pride of Arizona. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break to talk a little bit more about the Pride of Arizona. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson, the Wonder Edition, where we celebrate the good things at the University of Arizona. One of those is the U of A marching band, the Pride of Arizona. With us is the director, Chad Shoop. Good morning again.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. You know, there is a rich tradition with the Pride of Arizona. I've been around for a long time. And tell us a little bit about the history of the band and why it is so important to the just the overall framework of the University of Arizona experience.
Well, the Pride was started in 1902 as part of an ROTC unit. And that's where a lot of sort of the band history comes from, a military background. It served as initially in more ancient times as signals for battle movements on the field or building up troop morale and things like that. And out of that came sort of a function of being there to, and back really it came from a time when you didn't have electronic amplified recorded music. And so how do you reach a bunch of people and inspire them and get people excited about whatever mission or football game was happening? So 1902 for the Pride of Arizona, we played our first football game in the 1920s, and then started to gain notoriety nationally really in the 1950s. So we were the best band in the West for a long time. That was our moniker. Jack Lee came in the 1950s, and after winning the interview for the position, he came from Ohio State and Michigan. He flew over Bear Down Gym and saw that, asked about the story, was inspired by it, and wrote on a napkin, basically on the airplane, the initial strains of Bear Down Arizona. And then, obviously, when he came back, he wrote it and ended up making that our fight song, which has now really supplanted the fight songs that we had before, which is Fight Wildcats, which you heard in your bumper music coming off of the break.
Right.
And we occasionally play that when we kick field goals and things like that. So we're lucky that we have two fight songs. And then that, Jack was here for a long, long time, all the way through the 70s. And then we went through a series of really fantastic directors. And then I joined the band in the 90s, not to date myself, but had an opportunity to do that, but I took over in 2016 in the leadership. But in that time, I, you know, they played Bear Down to wake up the space shuttle crew.
Right.
The University of Arizona was marched in Jimmy Carter's inauguration parade, but is perhaps most famous for being the halftime entertainment for Super Bowl I in the 1960s. And so that's something that is really wonderful. And so the impact, not only locally, but nationally, is something that I think the Pride of Arizona is sort of a unique entity in that regard. And in the pantheon of all athletic bands and marching bands across the country, U of A's got a very rich history, one of the richest. Yeah. And so that's really a wonderful thing. And then when I took over in 2016, I wanted to continue a lot of that and focus to that.
The program and you personally and your students have been recognized with the Sudler Trophy, which a Los Angeles reporter once referred to it as the Heisman Trophy of marching bands. And you're going to have a special presentation in November at the football game for the Sudler Trophy. But could you just explain what that means, once in a organization's history to get that, and why that's so important?
Well, it is really the biggest national award a collegiate marching band can earn. And as you mentioned, you can only win it once in the program's entire history. And it celebrates the contributions of the program, the alumni, the faculty and staff and previous directors. It's a program-wide award that is something that we're the, fifth band west of the Mississippi to ever win it. We're only the 34th band to win it. And obviously the last Pac-12 band to win it of the three that have ever won. We're very excited about it because it speaks to the legacy that anybody that's ever participated in the Pride, and really this is an award for the community and the university because it allowed us to have those opportunities. I think the most important thing about it is that you can only win it once. It's a traveling trophy like the Stanley Cup, so we'll get to keep it for 2 years, and I'm talking to our athletics department about putting it in the Hall of Champions, and then you can order, and we will order a replica that'll live there forever. But in the initial part of it, we get the actual trophy, and it's got our name on it, and it lives there emblazoned forever. And it's something that I hope the community is incredibly proud of. And November 15th is the game we're getting the award. That's the Friday night game against the University of Houston. We're looking forward to that. We're bringing back previous directors and someone from the John Philip Sousa Foundation who gives this award. John Philip Sousa was the first director of the United States Marine Band and is most famous for his marches, if you're familiar at all with that, like the Stars and Stripes Forever that everybody knows. His foundation is the one that awards this, and that there'll be a representative out for that. I want to invite Desiree and our president to come out and be on the field to help accept that award, because it's something the university should be proud of, the community should be proud of, and certainly I'm incredibly proud of an organization that I was in and now getting to lead to be able to bring that, I think, very worthy recognition to us and our
family. And a lot of that credit goes to you, Chad. So what's really important is how can the community help you? You know, I help you try to get lunches sponsored for game day. So we need 300 lunches, 7 home games. We got to get lunches every day set up for the band. We try to arrange some sponsorships in exchange for some announcements just to help you. You're getting brand new uniforms this year. We're trying to get them cleaned a couple of times during the season and so forth. So how can people help you and help promote the band? You don't get a bunch of money from the athletic department or from the university per se. It's eat what you kill, as they say. You got to raise the money in order to make this happen. So how can we help?
Well, I appreciate you asking that. There's several different ways. Obviously, resources are always something that can help. The primary goal in any sort of giving, from my perspective, is the student experience has to be paramount in everything that we do. So everything that we are given or somebody donates, that ends up being something that goes directly to the student experience, and I think that's the most critical element. So there are in-kind donations, like you mentioned, being able to provide, lunches for the students on game days, because those are long days for the kids. Obviously, there are opportunities to donate just direct funding, and the community came together and really helped with our new uniforms. I mean, we're debuting new uniforms, a new drum line. We're really excited about that. This 2024 season is a big one in terms of new conference, new athletic director, all of the new. We want to be there to be able to launch that. And so folks can reach out at www.prideofarizona.org and just see what's going on there. But there's an opportunity there to donate. If business owners want to partner with us, we're happy to recognize them at football games and announce them. And of course, social media presence. Our social media presence is actually pretty impressive. And we like to shout out our sponsors and folks that help us out. But I think it's most important to recognize that you're helping not just music students, not just band students, but literally university students from every college. So if you wanted to support the engineering school, you can do that through the Pride of Arizona. Same with nursing, same with veterinary, same with any major you can think of. Your donation goes to affect students in every college. And I think that's one of the most attractive things about the generosity of our community and any giving or in-kind donation that happens is that it serves so many different students.
Well, Chad Schupman, Director of Athletic Bands at the University of Arizona, congratulations on your Sudler Trophy, which will be awarded on November 15th. And just thank you for what you do for the students who are in your program and the great tradition that you continue to bring to the community, one of the most recognized things on campus. Everybody wants to hear the band. Everybody wants the band at their opening and so forth. So you do a great job of that. If you're interested in being interviewed on Jump in Tucson on the Friday business show, Success Stories, go to Tucson's jumpintucson.com and let us know a little bit about you. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. Thanks for listening, and bear down and go Cats, right?
Bear down, go Cats. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks, Chad Schupman. You're listening to Jump in Tucson.